Welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by Martin D-Bag Willis.
Oh.
I couldn't help it.
I know.
I forgot even the context, but he called himself one of these. Oh, because he was late, essentially, to record this.
That's
and
right.
He asked me not to call him the full name. As his nickname. So I didn't. I kind of adjusted it for you, at least.
I'll give you a pass.
Good. Yeah. Good. You're easy going, though. It's easy to get the pass from
geeky,
you.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. You can get away with it this time.
In fact, you're rarely very upset. I don't think you've been very upset on the show. Maybe concerned a couple times. But, so do you... You know, ever have you ever gotten like really upset on your show?
No. There was just one time where a particular person said some things that was so outrageous. I didn't say I got really upset, but I did definitely call her on it when she said the FAA has spent trillions of dollars on revamping something. I said, wait a minute. That just is impossible. If they spent over $1 trillion, the FAA spent over $1 trillion, I think we would know about it.
Right.
And so I kind of called her on it, but I didn't get angry. So mm-hmm. I never have, and I understand it's not really a good idea to get angry, especially on a live show, because it kind of, you know, it doesn't work.
You come across as a D-bag when you get angry.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen Bassett can do anger pretty well, actually.
He's not actually angry, though. He's kind of acting, and he's like, he's like punctuating his point in a dramatic and entertaining way.
Yeah. I guess it works.
It does. Which I can remind people, you know, that is the latest video we've posted on our UFO Congress video portal is Stephen Bassett. So you can see his 2018 talk full of vim and vigor on the UFO Congress video portal. You can find that at ufocongress.com or ufocongressvideos.com. We'll take you right there. And actually, we are posting today, this will be fun, the award that Cheryl Costa got. She got the UFO Researcher of the Year award. So we're posting our video where we explain why she got the award and then also her acceptance speech. So those will be up by the time the show airs for people to watch. The acceptance speech and everything will be free on the UFO Congress YouTube page. And then there'll be links to buying the DVD or watching it on the video portal. Video portal is very cheap, just a few bucks a month, and you get access to hundreds of lectures from the UFO Congress over the past few years. And the 2018 videos are going up at a rate of about 2 per week. So we're getting them up there very quickly.
Do you see how I did that amazing segue into this whole thing?
Yeah, you're incredible. That's why
I know. That's why I get paid the big bucks.
Exactly.
You know?
That's why we pay you trillions of dollars to join us every week on the show.
I think I would know about that.
Yep. No. So I should talk about the guest that we've got. A really cool guest. I am I was very excited to have him on. It's been a long time in the making, and it was well worth the wait because I love talking to him. I'm not sure if you've had him on your show, but this is Chris Cogswell. He is the director of research, the new director of research for MUFON. He's got a PhD in chemical engineering, where he focused on the study of nanomaterials. And so he's got a lot of really cool. He also has a degree. His bachelor's was in chemical engineering and philosophy from the University of New Hampshire. How weird is that combo?
Yeah. Wow. That's actually right near, not too far away from me, actually.
Mm.
UNH. Yeah.
Really cool.
Yep.
Yeah, and so that combination has made him, I think, even more interesting. So he also does his podcast. He's a podcaster, too. He's been doing it for a while called the Mad Scientist Podcast. And he's been a listener of my show for a long time. I think both of our shows, actually. That's how I first knew of him. And we've conversed a little bit back and forth. His flattery has gone everywhere. You know, it's been very helpful. It got him on my podcast. Although I would have had the new MUFON director of research probably no matter who it was, unless it was somebody really goofy. But this guy's not goofy. The only time he's goofy is when he intends to be goofy. So that's a good thing. He's got a great sense of humor and just an overall super cool guy. This is one of my new favorite people. And I think you'll hear why when you hear this interview.
Excellent. I really enjoyed your interview immensely last week.
Did you?
I really did. That was just awesome. That was wonderful.
Yeah. So there's another person, Tyler Rogaway. And yes. It's a lot of fun because he's, you know, another amazing addition to kind of now in the UFO realm. He's a traditional mainstream journalist, and now he's interested in UFOs, and that's what's great. You know, both of these interviews are people who, and it shows how the field is, you know, certainly not stagnant. It might not be as exciting and sexy as, you know, people may want it to be, but in the background is probably what it should be. You know, lots of you know, there are some serious researchers making some headway and making some discoveries that are perhaps exciting only to those of us that are geeky enough to get excited about the tiniest little minutia when it comes to this field, but really good stuff.
You know, my brother-in-law has the same degree, and he...
Which one? Chemical engineering?
Yep, and he retired, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago from Los Alamos Laboratories.
Wow.
And I had a conversation with him. Now, my sister is very skeptical and just kind of rolls her eyes when I talk about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talked to him about it, he says, very possible.
Really?
It's very possible we're being visited. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's open-minded to it. So I think that's great when someone of science and someone like your guest is open-minded enough to know that these things could be possible.
Yeah.
Whatever they are.
Because it is possible. I mean, it is completely possible if there are these, you know, civilizations, which there likely are. Now, there was an article getting into, I guess, some of the news.
Oh, yeah.
There was an article, and I haven't read it because it was just posted today on Life Science and other places, why extraterrestrial life may be more unlikely than scientists thought. And
it's all about phosphorus, baby.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what it was, a lack of phosphorus that they see throughout the universe. However, as we've seen on our own planet, life can thrive in environments and using chemicals that, you know, we may not be aware of.
Yeah, I think it's a building block, though, what is very important for life to begin as far as phosphorus goes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I'm not a chemical engineer myself, so
yeah. Well,
what do I know?
You know, well, there was a scientist on my show maybe a year or two ago now, and interesting enough, he was arguing. We were talking about science, and of course, he was skeptical and talking about the lack of science and what it takes to actually do scientific research. But he also made the argument for divine intervention, or what is the word called? Divine. Kind of the creation of life by some sort of divinity. He argued that, you know, we don't know the origin. We don't know where life began. or how difficult it is for it to be created. We don't know that life, for instance, here on Earth started here on Earth. It could have, you know, been microbes that hitched a ride on an asteroid or something, which seems most likely, actually. So,
panspermia. You mean like divine conceptualism or something like that?
No, it's called,
Yeah, you know what you're saying.
Hopefully, yeah. I'll figure out what that word is. But essentially, yeah, just the idea that perhaps there was some sort of sort of entity that created that, some sort of creation entity that created us. You know, a religious sort of background, because he has a religious background, and we don't know. And if that's the case, where let's say we find out that life did hitch a ride on an asteroid, then we don't know necessarily where that the beginning is, where the origins of that life could have been, and what the environment was, what the chemical makeup of that environment was, or what it took to create that life. So this whole idea of life spawning from this primordial ooze on our own planet is becoming seemingly less likely, but we don't know what the beginning was. So who knows? Yeah,
it's a wonder, the very first spark of life. You know, I mean, how, you can really to wrap your brain around how that actually really started, where and when and all that. It's mind blowing.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the point being, we don't know. And this idea, you know, that there could be life many different places, then we just don't know. There's a much we do not know when it comes to all of this. But you haven't spoken with Chris then?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Interesting, though. I would probably like to.
Nice. I got another one you haven't had before. This is a good one. You're going to have to, of course, talk to both these guys because they're great. But without further ado, perhaps we should get into some UFO news, assuming you've got some.
Well, why not? Okay, so this comes from the National Geographic, and this is Luxury Space Hotel Could Cater to Travelers by 2022. Now, just hearing that number, 2022, that's not very far away at all.
Right.
So basically, if you have yourself an extra $20 to $40 million laying around, and you would like to buy a round ticket, hopefully it is a round ticket, then you can actually go to the space hotel, and only just a few years from now, if that's possible, 4 years from now, I can't understand how that could work. But anyway, so it basically says, with all the madness going on here on Earth, have you ever thought about going into space? Well, for a couple of $1 million, well, it's actually more than that, you might be able to check that off the bucket list worthy to do in the next 4 years. Orion Span, a Houston-based space tech startup, has announced plans to launch the first ever luxury space hotel into Earth's orbit by 2021. And how are they going to get, like, maid service and all that stuff up there? Wow. So the company says the so-called Aurora Station will be ready to accommodate visitors the following year. I just can't believe this can really happen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I guess I got that wrong. The price for a ticket for the 12-day stay will be $9.5 million per person, which comes to about $791,666 per night. So it should be pretty luxurious. I mean, I can't even imagine. So this is like a 43.5 foot long by 14 foot wide. So that's not very big. And anyway, it's pressurized, and it has a volume of 5,650 cubic feet. So compared to the International Space Station, it's much larger. I'm sorry, the space station is much larger at 357 feet. So I know, a lot of people would love to do this. It does seem kind of, dangerous, and you're spending that kind of money But if you make it there and back, it would be a heck of a thing to talk about, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would have to be a pretty incredible experience. I believe, yeah, you've got to get a lift from a rocket. That is kind of the scariest part, almost, is the trip up there. Luckily, you know, rockets rarely blow up, especially passenger ones these days. So you ought to be all right. But all the G-forces and everything. And then have you been watching at all this new National Geographic show, One Strange Rock?
No.
It is awesome. It's amazing. So it's narrated by Will Smith. Will Smith is kind of like the everyday guy who's breaking it down in layman's terms. But it's mostly narrated by the main narration comes from astronauts. And these astronauts are talking about what it was like, you know, to be in space and to observe Earth. And they're also talking about how the Earth works and different aspects of kind of how our planet operates and what we know about, for instance, the moon and oxygen. And it's just absolutely fascinating because of their perspectives of having been up there. And it's all, you know, tons of pictures and high quality imagery and video that was taken from up there. And I am a bit biased, and I'm not supposed to be, but it just happens. And because I've been able to go on at least one press trip. So the last press trip I did to Space Camp, that was at the time we weren't even supposed to talk about One Strange Rock because there was a press embargo where, you know, they weren't announcing much about the new show. Where we got to find out first time about Will Smith and stuff. But I also got to interview an astronaut, and I've got a couple astronaut interviews. And I'm going to post a story here real soon about One Strange Rock and hopefully have some more upcoming stories coming that will be coming. But I do have a story out there. So I talked about modernamerican.news, right, this new site that I have. And I've got it posted there. So modernamerican.news, and it's an interview with this astronaut. He's from Brooklyn, really, really cool dude. And in the interview, he talks about just, and you could probably imagine this, and this is something that, at least during the spacewalks, where when you get out into space and you're floating there, and there's you know, the space station, or in his case, maybe it was the space shuttle and the planet Earth, and you're just floating, you know, nothing between you and the planet, above the planet, and just what a sensory kind of overload that it is. And so that's what I interviewed this other guy who's on One Strange Rock about as well, and that's kind of going to be the gist of the story. But yeah, really, really cool stuff. So this show, though, sorry, I just get so excited about it all. I got off on the show does have the astronaut that I interviewed. His name is Michael Massimino, and among others. But they talked about the last one was the main person who was interviewed. I can't remember her name right now, but she spent the most time in space of anyone. And they had some pictures, and they were showing kind of the re-entry, which is probably what these people will experience, where essentially you're in this capsule that drops through the atmosphere. And then once you're through the atmosphere, you know, parachute drops. And this is cool. So this parachute drops, and then once they get close to the ground, boom, these rockets blow. And that's in order to soften the blow as you hit the Earth. But, you know, there's literally, when you're coming through the atmosphere, you see flames and fire, you know, because you're a ball of fire coming through the atmosphere. You're like a shooting star as you're coming through the atmosphere. And so that's got it's got to be a pretty crazy experience.
I know. Peggy Whitson.
Is that her name?
She was up, 665 days. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's her. She's awesome. Yeah, and this is incredible. I mean, these guys are awesome. I mean, I'm just such a huge fan of NASA and these people. You know, and I got to tell you, when you visit, you know, NASA facilities, or when you watch this show and you hear from these people, they are so professional and they choose the best of the best. Not only are these people, of course, scientists with PhDs, some of them multiple PhDs, they're physically fit because they have to be active, adventurous. To be an astronaut, you need to be a jet fighter pilot. These, you know, they teach you. If you're not a jet fighter pilot, when you get into the program, you will be, because you got to fly these jets. And they're just all people focused on safety, keeping people alive, and spending the American tax dollar wisely. And I mean, I'm just a big fan of all of these people. It's just a wonderful environment when you get a go be in a place where these people are, or interview some of these people. And that's what makes this show great. So definitely would recommend the show. And maybe after watching that, you'll be a little more hesitant about spending your $10 million. But you know what? 2022 is, you'll be able to go to this facility. But Bigelow and of course, Musk and others are working on other projects where, you know, I'm sure by 2030, there's going to be multiple different things you can pay for to get into space.
Right, right. That will happen. And now, there wasn't there that that low orbit, I don't want to call it a rocket, but it was like a some type of low orbit plane that it cost like $10,000 a ticket. Am I getting that? Do you remember anything about that?
No, nothing that is that low that I'm aware of. You may be thinking of Virgin Galactic. They've got their plane. They just started testing again, actually, because they're, you know, a couple years ago they had a crash. One of their test vehicles crashed and a pilot died, or I think two actually. So they just did another test flight, and that's going to kind of be a low Earth orbit. But I think that one's 200, 250 range. What you may be thinking of, because I'm not familiar with the price, is there's a giant balloon out of Tucson. And essentially, this balloon is attached to this pod that you go up. And you have to wear a spacesuit because you're going way up in the atmosphere to where there isn't any oxygen. So you have to wear this suit to get your oxygen. That one may be less. That might be around $10,000.
You know, I'd be up for trying something like that. I'd feel more safe attached to a balloon for some reason.
Yeah, that one sounds more safe to me. And I don't think you experience the G-forces and everything. That's the one that I think I would try. That's the one for us old dudes.
That's right. Who knows where the heck you're going to land, though?
Yeah.
You might land in some other country somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah. Mexico. Yeah. If you're in Tucson, you're pretty damn close to Mexico. So
then you'll never get over the wall.
Yeah. You'll be stuck on the other side of the wall. That would be awful. No. Oh, my goodness.
National Guard pointing guns at you. Wow.
So here's the last thing I wanted to talk about really quick, because we're running out of time, is and it's astronaut related, is this story about Buzz Aldrin and other astronauts taking lie detector tests to say that, you know, they really saw aliens. The story was written by the Daily Star, which is, of course, we complain about in UK tabloids all the time. Daily Star is like the worst of the worst. And of course, this story is the worst of the worst. It's not true. Buzz Aldrin has talked many times that he doesn't feel he did see something that was unidentified. He's certain that it was a part of a rocket. He said that many other times. In this story, they also said Edgar Mitchell had said he had seen multiple UFOs. Not true. He always said he had not seen any UFOs. He just believed the people who told him they had. And it turns out they didn't take lie detector tests. They had this person analyze their voices. And so this thing's gotten really big. But Newsweek, we posted a story from Newsweek at OpenMindset.tv, and there are others that are just saying, hey, guys, before you get too excited, this story's kind of goofy.
It's clickbait again.
It's clickbait, yep. So sorry about that. Otherwise, we're out of time, my friend.
Sure, I see that.
Yep. So thank you for joining us again, Martin. You can check out Martin at Podcast UFO. But let's go ahead and speak with Mr. Cogswell right after this break. happy to welcome to the show Chris Cogswell. Hello there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yep, I'm excited to talk to you. I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time. I know you do this podcast, The Mad Scientist, and you do write about and cover UFOs occasionally. And you're very grounded. It seems like, you know, you're a great thinker when it comes to that arena, which makes sense because you've got a PhD in chemical engineering and you teach. But now you are also MUFON's director of research.
Yes, I am. Whoa. Very excitingly. Yeah.
How long's it been since you've been doing that now?
I have been director of research, I think, grand total for maybe 3 months at this point.
So, and you went to Northeastern University.
Yep.
I misread that for a second. I was going to say, you mean J. Allen Hynek's alma mater, but it's not.
You know, it's funny. Those schools are often mixed up together, and hopefully someday myself and J. Allen Hynek will be mixed up together.
That would be really nice.
Great news.
So, and it is interesting, you've also studied philosophy.
Yes. Yeah, I got my bachelor's degree is in chemical engineering and philosophy.
How interesting.
Yeah, I think when I told my philosophy professors that that's what I wanted to do, they were all very excited. You know, they were like, oh, there's so many cool things, philosophy of science, economics, all this other stuff. And when I told my engineering professors, they just kind of, you know, like tilted their heads, you know, and were like, why do you want to do that?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, okay, there's that STEM bias, I guess. You know what I mean? But you need the humanities in there, so.
Yeah. Well, I could understand why they would feel that way, certainly, because it's going to take you away from what is already a monumental task of chemical engineering. But, you know, it makes you a much more well-rounded person, and I would imagine, especially covering fringe topics like this, that's come in handy for you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's been extremely. I mean, even in just the regular sort of, I guess, I don't know, academic sciences, I guess we could call them. You know, philosophy is really useful, especially in the idea of actually thinking about how you set up an experiment and what makes evidence really good versus, you know, something that can be simply thrown away with a little bit of logic. I mean, it's honestly, I think philosophy might have been more helpful to me than my chemical engineering and my PhD work. I mean, you know, I used my philosophy stuff every single day. I don't know, you know, I might have solved, I don't know, the friction losses in a pipe like 2 times in my whole grad school career. But I constantly wrote, I constantly thought about hypotheses and experiments and yeah, you know, and also, I mean, in those dark times in grad school, having philosophy to kind of turn to and be like, well, it's not all bad. You know, when your fifth experiment has failed that day and you're just, you know, you're at the bar trying to drown your sorrows.
Yeah.
Philosophy is useful there. So.
Well, you know, now I'm not going to be able to help myself but to delve into this, even though, you know, I wanted to be more science-oriented and talk about your new position. We can always do more than one podcast, but
oh yeah,
this is interesting because I find I exercise, and one must exercise, you know, philosophical ideas and concepts in this field because there's so much that is subjective, and you have to think about why people think the way they do, or in this case, believe the way they do, especially when you're working on, so for instance, and how this would apply to you, being a, kind of an academic, but also having these interests in the fringe, and then kind of observing the philosophy on why, you know, why the world view of most academics or scientists is such that it is difficult for them to you know, outwardly work on more fringe topics.
Yeah, it's a part of, you know, people like to think that science is this completely separate world from politics and economics and, you know, just personal biases and, you know, like the society and culture in which a science happens. But really, science is science is a human enterprise like any other, right? So when you look at the sciences in history and you say, okay, well, you know, why did this idea progress faster than this other one? Or why did it take, you know, why did it take this society a long time to, you know, believe in this theory versus this other society? There are usually, you know, social and cultural and all these other larger reasons for why the sciences never make it out of the lab in some cases. And so a big part of, I guess, the challenge both for convincing the scientifically minded, right, and maybe kind of the more intransigent skeptics out there, part of the challenge in convincing them that something has value to it, like the study of UFOs, is kind of shaking them loose and saying, well, you know, I mean, there are other ways to look at this question, first off, but also there are all kinds of things that science has been intransigent about in the past that, you know, have led to some really interesting things, even if the ultimate, let's say, even if the ultimate, you know, reality or the ultimate kind of at the bedrock of this idea, what you find at the center there might not be what you were originally looking for, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it may not be the case that we are able to reverse engineer an alien propulsion system or something, but the discussion of these ideas, the looking at the possibility of UFO contact, or even looking at the claims of people that have said that they've had contact in some way, those might be instructive regardless of whether or not you come at them with the belief, you know, which I have, that these things have really happened, right? Mm-hmm. It can still be constructive and it can still be useful. And on top of that, too, it can still be educational, right? I mean, this is something that I keep trying to tell people is, you know, our generation was lucky because we had Bill Nye the Science Guy. But the previous generations had Star Wars and Star Trek and the X-Files. And I mean, the X-Files was kind of my generation, too. Mm. I'm kind of giving away my age here.
More mine. But, well, I'm guessing that you're the generation after me.
I am the generation that was terrified of the X-Files. Like, I was too young to watch the X-Files as a kid, but I was just old enough to, like, you know, hear the music going to bed at night and pull the covers up a little bit closer to my face.
That's hilarious.
That's kind of the age that I was at. And now I'm appreciating them as an adult now. But yeah, I mean, a lot of scientists, a lot of people, just the general public, get excited about science in its application to things like science fiction or these questions of, you know, anomalous research and stuff. So, again, there's something useful about discussing these topics from the viewpoint of teaching very good science to people, right? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you can't get someone excited about ecology when you're talking about, you know, wrens or I don't know, herons or some other kind of species or whatever. But when you're talking about the ecology of a different planet and what effect that might have on an alien species, that's a little bit juicier, right? It's not
right.
As dry.
And to your point, you know, with my generation, for example, with Star Trek and Star Wars, although the original Star Trek's even older than my generation.
Right.
But it's complete fiction. However, and it was a bit of an intransigent topic in that, you know, oh, you know, they're looked down upon, you know, science fiction. Mm-hmm. And so it was a little bit in the closet. Now it's not like that whatsoever. But scientists admit, and there are some that do talks. There's a guy here at ASU who makes thousands of dollars doing the science of Star Trek talks all over the place. He's a professor there. Krauss, you probably are aware of him. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, and many people talk about how their science was inspired by Star Trek. So those ideas, that kind of brainstorming that happens in the creative process of creating the television show, inspired these people to work on technologies that they got the ideas from the shows.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I mean, I think, too, a big part of this field is that ultimate question that you kind of started this out with, which is, why do people believe the things that they do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting to the bottom of – so there's kind of, I think, a couple of different ways to look at this. But from the first let's take the supposition that alien life forms exist, or that UFO cases are genuine. People are really seeing something, right? Which, again, I just think there's a – the mountains of evidence, I think, is too great to suggest that there is nothing there. But we're going to start from that supposition that aliens or UFOs exist, UFO craft are visiting here. Okay. Either then, the scientific public, the scientific academic world, is by accident, or maybe not by accident, but is incorrectly assigning to this idea of falsehood. So they're kind of, it's a real phenomena, but they're saying it's false. Or it is a false phenomena that the believers are accidentally or incorrectly saying is true, right? So either have a false negative or a false positive here.
Mm-hmm.
In either case, there are things that we can learn, right? You know, we have a lot of interesting stuff going on right now about the power of misinformation and the power of ideas to spread across the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you were in the UFO field, you saw that happen firsthand since the internet started.
Right.
Right. I mean, I remember going on forums and stuff back when I was in middle school, you know, I mean, 12, 13 years old, and reading stories that had been debunked then that are still coming up on web pages, right?
That's
that I'm
funny,
still reading about today.
Because that's how I felt about the X-Files, being someone older and already, you know, researching and involved in this field, thinking, that stupid show, that's nothing like what, you know, we really experience. So I didn't watch it for a few years because I was so frustrated that it was this silly idea of, you know, how all this really goes. Of course, eventually I totally fell in love with it, and I still am. Right.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think, again, I don't know. I think that the same time we've had the UFO field itself, I think, has for a long time as well, focused on this question in sort of one way, right? Which is sort of this idea of, you know, structured craft, I guess, or, you know, what are these ships made of, right? And over time, we've seen it kind of broaden now to groups starting to talk about more the metaphysical questions, the philosophical sides of this.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, I think from my perspective, what I hope to bring to this is looking at this as well from a more a broader approach scientifically as well. Right. Those philosophical questions are fascinating. And it's something that I really do enjoy about philosophy is sort of the metaphysical existential questions that these sciences, that these technologies cause us to have.
Hmm.
But we also, though, should be looking at the UFO phenomena as a very interesting sociological phenomena, or just a problem of statistics, even, right? No one's really done good, solid statistical work on this stuff.
I so agree. I mean, I very, very much agree. I mean, I always argue, even though it's not as sexy, that, you know, the sociological aspects are just as important, if not more so.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we've been able to bring on some sociologists, some statisticians, some cognitive scientists, some, you know, people that are looking at this problem from these angles that, you know, a physicist, an engineer wouldn't necessarily think of looking at, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing that I've always thought, because I'm a material scientist, that's kind of my research was on nanomaterials, was on the creation of basically these solids, these crystals that you could alter in different ways chemically. And in fact, kind of interestingly, the stuff that I worked on was metamaterials, which is kind of fun because that's now what's the big thing in the UFO field, right? So I've been very happy to, you know, go on the internet and see people talking about layered ceramics and layered materials and stuff, and I'm like, that's what I did my PhD on. That's perfect, right?
Which is funny you bring that up, because I totally forgot that was one of the big topics I want to hit on. And
oh, great.
We're going to run out of time, but
yeah.
We'll get there.
That's okay. We'll get there. One aspect that I've always thought is fascinating about these things is there's a lag, right? And we've seen this noticed in the UFO literature for a while, too, by other people. You know, I'm not the first person to have this idea. But I find it really interesting, the lag between, you know, in some cases when you're reporting a UFO that you've seen, if you were in the 50s or the 60s, you would report the UFO as having technology that in the 50s and 60s would seem cutting edge, right? And, you know, to me, that's kind of one of the hallmarks of either there being a sociological connection to this phenomena, you know, some kind of cultural thing, or, you know, or the possibility that those things aren't, I don't know, that those cases aren't as necessarily trustworthy as others, right? Because potentially there is some kind of confabulation there of someone's memory or whatever. But the things that I always look for in these cases are the technologies that are really so far out that we'd never consider before, right? And so one of those technologies would be nanotech. You know, previously we had this notion that as our technology got better, everything would just get bigger and bigger in some ways, right? Ships would get bigger, our propulsion energies would get stronger, our, you know, whatever. But now, you know, since the 90s, it's the other way. We're going smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. And so for me, some of these cases where you have someone saying, you know, well, it just looked like the inside of the ship looked like a bare surface, or, you know, this thing didn't seem to have any kind of clear, you know, fins or tails or anything like that or whatever, or even the cases of seemingly drone-like orbs or I don't know, if, you know, craft, whatever you want to call them. To me, those are the fascinating ones because it's hinting at a type of technology that and these I mean from in the past as well, right? So you're reporting something in the 60s that doesn't make sense through the lens of the 60s, but today, you know, looks like a clear technology, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's very fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because, for instance, a cell phone, an iPhone, in the 50s, if they would have found that, the academics, I'm sure, of course, it has English writing on it, but they would have probably thought this is technology way beyond. There's no way this could even, we're not going to get to this for 100, 200 years or more because it's so advanced. I don't think anybody would have, you know, thought there's any way we could compact all of that technology into this tiny little thing in the next couple hundred years.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it is literally, I mean, yeah, you're completely right. If we went back in, if we went back 100 years with a cell phone, there would be parts of the world where people would think that it was magic. Right? I mean, it's it's not a, and that's why to me, and that's also why, though, I think it's important to have a team of people who are from all kinds of different disciplines, because the things that I might find to be fascinating about these cases aren't necessarily the things that a biologist or a sociologist or a archaeologist or, you know, medical doctor, nurse, whatever. Like, the things that I clue in on are not going to be the things that you clue in on, right? And so that's why it has to be a very collaborative effort. And that's why, you know, we're really trying to work with other teams through MUFON research and also trying to bring in people if they're interested. So
here's a question along those lines of the sociological aspects and belief and all of this. And I think it's on the minds at least of some of my listeners and some more that have been following kind of the recent, I don't know, background with MUFON and everything, is that I think there's been this feeling within UFO research that MUFON has kind of gravitated towards the more fringe and has been struggling a little bit more with the actual science. Was that a concern of yours when you accepted this position? Do you feel that's true? And have you had any difficulties?
So when I first joined and when I first took on this position, I actually sort of I at first thought I was like, I'm definitely going to get kicked out of this organization because I came in like, you know, guns blazing, like, that's not science and that's not science. And, you know, really kind of writing some angry emails.
Well, right? To be honest, there were other people that felt that way because there was kind of a bit of an exodus of science-minded people. And I think even some people I had talked to thought, wow, this guy's great. He really knows science. How long is he going to last? You know,
Right. I mean, you know, so the thing with MUFON that I think a lot of people don't, I mean, I'm sure your listeners know this, but this is something that I've come across in the general public is like, people don't realize MUFON isn't really centralized in the way that I think people think it is. It's much more sort of, you know, local chapters that come together into this larger thing.
Yeah, right? I've been telling people that for decades.
Yeah, so MUFON is very much – MUFON operates more like the United States than, say, the United States governmental system, let's say, than, I don't know, Parliament or something in the UK, right? So it's like, you know, the chapter of MUFON in Texas is completely different than the MUFON chapter in Oregon and the chapter in, you know, New York and whatever. So it really depends on the chapter you go to. So because I have talked to some dyed-in-the-wool skeptics, you know, and skeptics is kind of, you know, because I would consider myself to be skeptical. I would say, let's say people that I would say are very anti-UFO research, who have told me that in their minds, it is the local chapters that are far more scientific than the upper echelons, let's say, of MUFON. And I've had people tell me the exact opposite.
Right,
where it's, you know, the local chapters are very fringy and metaphysical and whatever. To me, what I have found is that, so to answer your question a little bit better, yes, it was definitely a concern of mine. It was something that I tried to lay out very strongly in my, even in my application, right? There was a, you know, one of the questions that was asked to me is, well, what are your biases, right? And I said, you know, well, I am scientifically trained. I am scientifically minded. I am not a particularly religious person. I don't necessarily believe in more of the sort of, I guess, you know, really hard fringe, almost edging towards paranormal claims that come about in the UFO field. But that being said, I'm very open-minded, and also, you know, gave kind of my clear indications of, well, you know, this is kind of what I want to try to do. And in particular, what I'm hoping to do is sort of put MUFON in a position where we are gatekeeping. Sounds like gatekeeping is too strong of a term, I think. But what MUFON in its role should be able to do, I think, is act as almost a focus to edge out, or not necessarily edge out, but almost sort of prune away the tree of all of the things that are starting to encompass UFO research, and actually try to get to some kind of pragmatic, workable answers, right? I mean, there are cases that we have been talking about for longer than MUFON has been around, right? There are ideas that have been, you know, handily proven to be false or inconsistent or illogical that are continued to be talked about. There are, and at the same time, there are very good ideas that don't get the sort of attention that I think they deserve because we're too busy focusing on the big things, right?
Right. I totally agree. Unfortunately, I have to stop you right now because we do have to go to break, but we'll be right back. And we'll pick up on that because I think that this is really interesting. But for those of you who are listening on KGRA, you're going to hear some commercials here. Check out these great people who are helping support KGRA and keep them on the air. And then for those of you listening to the podcast, you'll hear a short musical interlude. But we will be right back with Christopher Cogswell, so stay tuned. welcome back to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we are speaking with Chris Cogswell, the Director of Research for the Mutual UFO Network. And you were just talking about what sounds like a really big task, which is kind of paring away some of maybe, and I know you were struggling with the words too, because you don't want to offend anybody, trying to pare away kind of the stuff that you can't do much with and get to the meat of the issues. And I guess you're getting to the success you've had with that.
Yeah. So, absolutely. So the big thing that we've been able to start doing really is, first off, we are going through the last. So MUFON has the case management system, right? We have all of the cases that have been given to MUFON over the years, and all of that information is digitized. And all of it now is in a easily searchable, filterable form. So what we are starting to do is apply some very heavy statistical analysis to these ideas to try to get to some answers, or at least get some numbers on this thing, right? So some of the ideas that, for instance, intrigue me that are kind of I don't want to say low-hanging fruit, because it implies that these are going to be easy to answer. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, these are pieces of info. These are tests that have single variables, let's say.
Or right? Perhaps because MUFON has so much data, I mean, things that are discoverable inside the data you already have.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's entirely that's perfectly what I mean. So one of these ideas would be, we often hear that UFO hotspots exist, right? Is that true, or is this just confirmation bias, right? Mm. Well, let's look at the data. We often hear that UFOs appear around bodies of water, right? Again, is that borne out in the data, or is that simply confirmation bias, or just some kind of idea that's out there?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that, so another a thing almost that I would liken this to, and it, you know, is sort of when the difference between criminology before the FBI really became actively involved in interstate analysis versus afterwards, right? So beforehand, if you committed a crime in a state and then moved a state over, there was no way to link those two crimes because your records weren't necessarily shared, right? That's kind of been the case in the UFO field, where, you know, each local chapter knows what cases is analyzed. But if you're, you know, you're in Texas and someone else is in Oklahoma, they're not necessarily going to know that you had a case that is stunningly similar to their case, you know, an hour after their case happened.
Right.
So it might be possible, we're hoping, and this is just kind of this is all kind of pie in the sky stuff at the moment, but we're getting there, is the analysis of, well, okay, if there is a clear pattern of cases that are occurring in states next to each other in times that seem to be consistent with each other, then can we say that this is one craft being viewed by multiple witnesses, right? Trying to link these cases together in ways that are interesting. Or, you know, even the question of what is the most commonly seen craft shape? What is the most commonly seen lighting pattern?
Mm-hmm.
All of these questions are fascinating. Another one that's extremely interesting is, you know, are there times of year where these cases are more prevalent? Do those link up with, are those simply linked up to things like, you know, okay, well, maybe we see more sightings in the summer because more people are outside, right? Or the days are longer or whatever. If we can show that statistically the difference is significant enough to overcome that increased daylight time or something, then that's a piece of real evidence that we can point to.
See,
right?
That is great, because I haven't done one actually in the last couple of years. I used to do kind of a hot spot, or at least year end statistical, or at least analysis, number analysis.
Sure.
And it wasn't necessarily that. But I would, in order to find out if there are hotspots, match it up against population. So
yes,
sightings per population. But even then, that would give me some info, but I just didn't have enough access or necessarily time to do much more. But I think what you're talking about is kind of For a lot of maybe even the listeners are like, you're kidding, MUFON doesn't already do that. But they haven't had the resources to do that, even though all of this data exists to be able to discover some of those things. So that is great to hear that you'll be working towards that.
Yeah, the challenge is that, well, first off, the challenge is, you know, the accessibility to this type of database management software and statistical analysis stuff. You know, technology has gotten better and better. You know, it's just gotten tremendously useful today. Where, you know, if you are at home right now listening, you can download download a guide to Python and write your own thermodynamic code, right? Like, that kind of stuff can happen from your home because of the power of the internet, the power of computers, all that stuff. So, you know, 10 years ago, this method or this ability might not have been there, but today it is. And so it's more been an issue of, I would say with anything kind of like this, where it's a big group of volunteers, the challenge is getting the people that are excited and energized enough to do it, mm-hmm. kind of mobilizing those people. And then on top of that, too, you know, we have to be very careful to do it in a way that is both ethical, right? Because really, MUFON is collecting data on humans, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're collecting sociological, in some ways, data. So we need to ensure that our testing, you know, and testing is, you know, basically people answering survey questions, but still, that has to be done in a way that removes bias, that it ensures that there is no implicit, systematic problem in our data collection process, mm-hmm. that there is no, you know, there's all kinds of things that even if you are someone who has been doing this for a long time, like I would consider myself to be scientifically trained. But I am not qualified to come up with a statistical analysis of a giant population.
Right.
I don't know that stuff. I haven't been trained.
Yeah, I've got a bachelor's in psychology, but if I were to conduct, you know, a study like that or be asked to, I would want to, as I'm sure you know, you always want to go to the expert. You would want to go to someone who another probably psychologist or someone who does this.
Absolutely.
Sort of research.
And I think the problem, or I think one of the challenges has been for organizations like MUFON in the past has kind of been both getting your foot in the door with those people and then also finding people that are, again, interested in this stuff enough that you can get this to happen. Mm-hmm. And that is another kind of, I think, change point that we are at right now is that, again, you know, all of the people right now that are getting their PhDs or are just starting labs or are going into industry or whatever, all of those people, again, were raised on Star Wars and the X-Files and mm-hmm. stories of UFOs and stuff. And so for, I think, again, it's kind of an inflection point in the population where, you know, the kind of resistance to this idea or the resistance to this study is being ebbed, you know, it's kind of being eroded away over time. And so it is a lot easier. I mean, I tell people this all the time. Every time I went to a bar in grad school, all anyone ever wanted to talk about was UFOs and ghosts and sports, right? And I don't really care about sports, but I sure like UFOs and ghosts and stuff, right?
Yeah, so it was like, me.
You know, that was what we talked about. And, you know, I have yet to find someone who is at one of these big science conferences or a professor or anything like that. I have yet to find someone who is interested in this stuff so long, again, as it is couched in the right way, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's the challenge. Even the metaphysical stuff, even these ideas of consciousness bending or, you know, there's a study being conducted right now about people who have supposedly had contact with other, you know, non-human intelligences while on psychoactive drugs, right? It's about conducting that study, that research in a way that is justifiable scientifically, and then also talking about this stuff in the careful kind of way that it has to be talked about so that you are working from a long tradition of good academic science and thinking, and not even science, good philosophical thinking, so long as you're within that wheelhouse, so long as you're within that same line, and so we move these ideas into the categories where I think that they should exist, you know, I don't think there's going to be a problem at all finding people interested in working with us. And there hasn't been so far.
Yeah, good. So I'm going to touch on a couple things really quickly so we can move on to my next line of questioning in the little bit of time we have left. But what you're getting at, and I don't want to put words on your mouth, so frame it in the way that you feel best, but you have not found resistance, or maybe you want to say you are helping to change a culture that exists there at MUFON, or...
There's always a little bit of resistance when the new guy comes in and tries to flip the table over, right? There's always a little bit of resistance, but it has not been, I would say it's more been sort of the, almost a more of a mentor-mentee kind of scenario where the people that have been doing this for a lot longer than I have said, you know, well, why don't you try this first? Or, you know, slow down a little bit, let's try this idea, whatever. So there has not been, I would say, resistance or struggle or anything like that. I would say it's more been, I'm kind of raring to go, and people are like, well, you know, don't bite off more than you can chew. I guess is almost how I would say
that. Right there is really good advice, and because, you know, like you said, you know, a lot of MUFON's decentralized, and people wonder why can't MUFON do this or that, and you know, it's enough work to run an organization that large. So the people at the headquarters, you know, they've got their hands full with that. So that's good advice, not to bite off more than you could chew. But my advice, being someone who worked with that board quite a bit, is to run. Do your thing, because that's also got to get done. But moving on to the next topic, I guess, would be... Oh, and one more comment. It's just funny what you talked about, the framing of the topic and people getting involved. The last interview I had last week was similar. He said something similar, and he's a defense journalist. And he says everybody in aviation is into UFOs. If they're not, if they say they're not, they're lying. It's just because, you know, they're timid about sharing that because of... It hasn't been presented in a very credible way many times. But I want to move into a topic I know that you have some passion about. I think you even might have shot me some questions. I don't remember, but I have seen you have commented on this. And I haven't been able to pay enough attention to what you were getting at, unfortunately, because I've been looking forward to having the opportunity to talk to you here on the podcast. And that is related to these new revelations, of course, that came from Lou Elizondo and Department of Defense. And you in particular, like you said, have experience with metamaterials. And using the term, you're obviously familiar with Elizondo saying, no, these are metamaterials. They're not alloys, like people had said. But metamaterials with, you know what, I've got my notes because I wanted to be very clear with him as to what he was saying and what he was approving me to say. But he said that they had isotopic ratios that were unique. So how do you feel about those statements?
So first off, for the listeners, right? A metamaterial is a material that has been that has literally just been engineered in some way to give it some kind of structure or use that is not usually found in kind of average nature, right? So the example of the metamaterials that I worked on that are very simple, actually, in this case, would be, imagine you have a rock or you have a surface, a ceramic material, that then you load onto that ceramic material a metal nanoparticle, right? So it can absorb, it can pull in other pollutants or something from water. That is technically a metamaterial. The term metamaterial is sort of thrown around a lot, but it doesn't really mean anything more than a material that has been engineered at generally the micron scale, sometimes the nanoscale, for different purposes. Now, this concept of isotopic ratios. So to me, almost, this isotopic ratios thing is sort of one of those ideas of like a piece. Remember how before I said that there was evidence that we might think would be useful or interesting, or a technology that we thought was useful, but then 20 years later we look at it and we're like, why did we think that was something that might be useful? To me, isotopic ratios is sort of that. Right now, when we have a piece of material that comes from space, what we will do is look for the isotopes that are present inside that material. So the isotopes are just the basically the material that it's atoms with different numbers of neutrons. So it's a more it's a heavier or lighter atom of a certain type than we would expect in nature. So the one that I have seen most often mentioned is zinc, zinc and copper. Now, I was sent some slides to analyze on this, not by anyone, just by someone in the UFO field. But to me, those isotopic ratios were within the margin of error for standard on Earth. If we found, and that's not to say that these are the same Elizondo slides or anything like that or their material, but in my mind, if we were going to find out, if we were to get a piece of a metamaterial that was engineered by an alien civilization, there would be a lot better evidence than isotopes. There would be nanoengineering, nanostructuring. There would be crystal structures that can't thermodynamically exist on the surface of the Earth. There would be special properties or, you know, opening or closing of the crystal lattice structure. So the volume changes per unit cell, you know, that those kind of properties that we can create on Earth, but would require a lot of doing. That's the kind of stuff that I would be looking for. So I wouldn't be looking for, you know, it's kind of the question I always bring people is if you were to travel to if you were to travel to space, how would you do it? In my mind, it's the same thing. If I was going to engineer a material, how would I do it? I wouldn't just be mixing together different, I don't know. I don't think that the isotopes thing is really a smoking gun. For me, a smoking gun would be something like, you know, they've mentioned that this thing might be layered in some way, that it has a some kind of layering structure. To me, that might be a smoking gun, not necessarily these isotope ratios.
That is a great point. So, and you need someone with your experience to make it. So the point is the isotopic ratios aspect of this material isn't as exciting as the metamaterial aspects and what those properties may be. Now, one of my questions, though, is it difficult to determine whether something is a metamaterial? Is it possible that a mistake could be made? In other words, they see something at the micron level, at a very small level, that appears to be something that is, you know, perhaps manufactured, when it turns out that it's not. It's just a strange natural formation.
So the this kind of has, I think, a simple and a long explanation, or a simple and
difficult. We've only got a couple minutes.
All right, so we'll go with a slightly simple one. The test that I would run on this material, if I had access to this material, I would run X-ray diffraction. I would run a pore surface analysis to get the surface area and the pore volume of the material. I would run elemental composition to try to see if there were are there organic chemicals on this thing, or is it simply metal, right? Is it simply metal or metalloid? If it has organic components, and by that I don't mean biological. I just mean carbon, hydrogens, oxygens. If there are organic components, that would suggest potentially the presence of some kind of engineering of the structure. And the other thing too that I would say is when we get supposed asteroid remains or pieces of meteorite or whatever that falls to Earth from space, one of the first things we do is run it through an XRD, an X-ray diffraction machine, to see if the XRD matches up with a known material. XRD is basically like the fingerprint of a crystal structure. Okay. So if you have some kind of mineral, right? That mineral type will have the same crystal structure everywhere on the planet, basically. So if I had, you know, if I had something like zeolite X or Y or something, that would have the same X-ray diffraction pattern no matter where I found it from, right? And when we have pieces that come from space, sometimes what we actually will do is we will run those through an XRD to see, does this structure exist on the Earth as we currently know it? And if it doesn't, does it have properties that might be useful? So for instance, there are labs right now that do that kind of work to make new magnets, right? So magnets that don't use rare earth elements, right? So there are labs currently in the United States that do that kind of research, specifically on materials that come from space. And as far as I can tell, this is not the kind of testing that they would do that's being done. So,
although we don't know.
We don't know. That's the thing. If they are running – like, that's the thing. The people that are on this team, I'm very hopeful that these kind of tests are being run, right? And this is the kind of stuff that's happening. But from my perspective as a material scientist who specifically worked on nano-engineered solids, if I was looking to see if it was nano-engineered or from an intelligent source or something, I would be looking for non-Earth stable thermodynamic phases. So things like crystal structures that couldn't form here. I would be looking for things like synthesis or crystal growth that required multiple steps or stages, which would suggest chemical synthesis. And I would be looking for materials that are maybe scarce on Earth or difficult to find, right? That's what I would be looking for.
That makes sense. We are out of time. So this interview was well worth the wait. You certainly delivered. I've been excited to talk to you, and this has been great. So I know I'm going to want you back on a regular basis, especially I want to follow up with some other things to talk about. But this has been very helpful. So thank you, Chris. And you still run your Mad Scientist podcast, right?
Yes, I do. So part of my goal with MUFON Research is to be as transparent as possible. I hope the podcast can help me do that. And you can check out the podcast. The other thing, though, that I want to say is if you are an independent researcher with a good idea and you want access to MUFON's cases, you want access to the statistical analysis isn't done, but if you want access to that kind of raw numerical data, please send me an email. We have always been welcome, and we've always been excited to work with outside groups. The thing is that, again, we have to be careful about people's personal information. We don't want to give that away, right? So the database.
So you'll give the details. Sorry, we're just so short on time.
Yes, absolutely. So just send me an email, please.
Awesome. That is really good to hear. So thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Chris Cogswell for being on the show. What an awesome guest. I am now a huge fan of his, so I wish him the best at MUFON. I think that if anybody's going to do a wonderful job and get things on the right track, it's going to be Chris. So all the best luck to you. Godspeed, my friend. Otherwise, check out his podcast, the Mad Scientist Podcast. You can just Google that. You'll be able to find it. I'll have a link also in the show description. I also want to thank Martin Willis from Podcast UFO for joining us for the news. Remember, all of that news at the beginning of the show you can find at openminds.tv. And there's a couple of other ways to get that information. You can get it on our Facebook and also on our Twitter. And you can also get that at the UFO Congress Facebook and Twitter. Also, we share that information there as well. So multiple ways for you to get the info that you need to stay up to date on the latest on credible UFO information. Also, when it comes to the UFO Congress, we have some videos that are going up every week. This week, like I talked about with Martin, we're going to have Cheryl Costa's lecture going up, and then also the video of her receiving her Researcher of the Year award. Of course, those of you who listened to the show remember the last show we did with her where we talked about some of the cool things she's done lately, but I kind of encapsulate her whole history and everything in this video that we've got on YouTube, so you can see all of the great things that she did. And you know, these videos are cool because once you watch the video, it's a no-brainer. You see, aha, that's why she won the award. It's obvious. But I also want to thank Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music, and I want to thank Systematics, who does the bumper music, and you, the listener. We'll have another show in a week. Until then, adios muchachos.